everyone was surfing and I couldn't even swim. And you know, just a, I always say this story where I was invited to a pool party and they said, come to my pool party, bring your cozy. And this is pre-Google. And I was so traumatized going, what is a cozy? Just trying to get my head around it. Till my auntie said to me, it means a swimming costume. It's this Aussie like slang for it.
Story for you.
I'm Matt Levinson. My guest today is an architect whose career and life has taken her on a very different path to a lot of her peers. Belkis Yousafzai worked on the original plan to replace the Powerhouse Museum and the tiny set for Urban Theatre Project's latest stunning piece at Bankstown Art Centre. She's a writer, a photographer with an ephemeral style and a sharp intellect. There's a lot of talk right now about creative culture and where the edges of that are. I've always thought it extends way out of the traditional forms, you know, into areas like science, food, architecture. And with my guest today, that's so clear. A friend mentioned Belle's work while we were out cycling, and from then on, I saw it everywhere. And the more I found out about Belkis's work, the more I wanted to find out. That's what this podcast is about, talking to people who make great things happen and getting to know what makes them tick. How they got to be the person they are now. Belle, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you for having me.
We're sitting up here in this beautifully converted old hospital in Zetland, you know, adaptively reused by the great architect Peter Stutchbury. But I want you to like start this story back a lot earlier than that. You know, you grew up in Afghanistan in the 80s, under Soviet occupation at that time. What can you remember of that time? I mean, you were a small child at the time.
I was, and I think it was a very interesting time. I was born 5 years into the Soviet occupation in 1984. So it was an interesting time to be growing up in. It was culturally, socially, and politically a very different landscape to the one I'm living in now. And I think those formative years were really important in shaping how I approach life in Sydney now as a practitioner, as an adult. One thing that I think has stayed with me, apart from the fact that it was a very politically volatile time, but it was also, in many ways, the later part of my life in Afghanistan was the civil war and the country on the brink of a civil war. So there was a lot of violence, you know, a lot of public school was attacked a couple of times. You know, parents were quite scared that if the kids went to school, they might not come back. So I think, you know, in many ways, they were difficult times as a child, but at the same time, they were important in kind of helping me form some ideas around, you know, social values, I guess, I guess also my political leanings, but importantly, just understanding how a society of people in Afghanistan, a whole community of people, showed resilience and strived under such pressure. So I think that I've carried through into my life now as an adult living in Sydney.
What about in a creative sense? You know, I guess like when people think about Afghanistan through that period, they're not thinking about creative culture. And yet you have this very creative urge that we're going to talk about through, you know, a few different projects that you've been involved in as an adult, I guess. But when you look back to your childhood back then, your parents and your grandparents and your sort of network of people who are around you, do you see clues to that kind of creative life as well?
Absolutely. I think one of the things, sad things about Afghanistan is that, you know, it's always seen through the lens of war and poverty and what we've been witnessing through our TV screens, what we consume through our TV screens, but it has historically been a very culturally vibrant place. Unfortunately, not one that I was part of growing up because everyone was trying to survive. Having said that, I come from a family of creatives. My father is an archaeologist. His whole PhD thesis was around Buddhist arts in Afghanistan. And my mum trained in architecture, even though back then it was kind of a mix between engineering and architecture. She's an accomplished painter. She does miniature painting. She trained in that. I have a family of creatives, you know, who ranging from painters to poets, with my father being, you know, involved in like this cultural sector of Afghanistan. We always had access to that part of it. So growing up, you know, my parents always, poetry was such a big part of our household. Even now my parents discuss the poetry of Hafiz and Beydil and all of these Afghan poets, which it's such a, you know, when I see it through kind of my Australian lens, it's just such a weird thing to be talking about poetry at dinner table, but that's how life was and that's how we grew up. So that part of Afghan culture was also a source of comfort growing up, you know, in the time of war. And I think in many ways, going back to that has been such a, In hindsight, that has been the reason why I've pursued such a path professionally, because growing up, I think we were deprived of that, and you know, being able to now then being able to see comfort in that, in the creative pursuit, in poetry, in things that were accessible but sometimes intangible, things that, you know, war couldn't stop, you know, poetry, singing, dancing, you know, painting. So I think that in many ways has been a companion for me into my adult life.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about it that way, I mean, clearly you were deprived of some of that, but also you had a very rich cultural life as a child from the sounds of the way you tell that story.
Yeah.
You know, in a way that a lot of, you know, people here don't have at all, you know, that kind of rich engagement with culture on a around the dinner table talking about poetry kind of way. I think that would be really foreign to a lot of Sydneysiders, right?
It is absolutely foreign in many ways, and that's something, it's kind of something I value, you know, even now, you know, when you go to an Afghan event, you know, because we have got a huge diaspora in Sydney and in Australia, you know, we talk about so many, you know, people talk about writing, people talk about, you know, we had a mosque built, you know, everyone wanted to talk about a community mosque, and everyone was kind of talking about the calligraphy and all these different forms of expression that really enrich the interior of this space. And I think, you know, that's a really lovely thing, because we, all of our lives, all of Afghan people who are living in Australia, and those of us who actually grew up during the war, it's always in our background, you know, that war life, that deprivation that we had, the you know, the years after that, because a lot of us moved to other countries in the interim before arriving to Australia or elsewhere. So I think that little bit of culture, and I think for me that is a very important part of me, because no matter where I go, I feel like I have a deeper, richer landscape that I carry with me. And I like that knowledge of, you know, this kind of much deeper and authentic part of me that sometimes people don't see, and that's okay too.
Yeah, it's like there's some really deep roots there.
Yeah.
How did you and your family come to leave Afghanistan?
It was a bit challenging for both my parents to leave, because at that time there was this mass exodus of especially professionals leaving Afghanistan. The country was on the brink of a civil war. And both my parents, my father was the director of the Institute of Archaeology in Kabul, and so he was quite an important figure. My mother, she was teaching, but she was also working for the town planning, which, as you would imagine, at that time there wasn't much town planning happening. So she was supplementing our income by making clothes. She's an incredible seamstress, as well as a painter, so a very creative woman. And so it got really hard. You know, food was rationed, you know, for the longest time. I remember we didn't have fresh eggs. And then it became unstable, you know, where there were many political coups. And as each leader left, you know, during just before the civil war, you know, they would drop bombs onto the city. And it just became really volatile and really unpredictable. And my parents, with three children, they just thought, now's the time to leave. At that time, my grandparents, my mother's parents, were living in New Delhi in India, because they had intended to go to the States where my uncle lived. but they were just kind of in a bit of a limbo in New Delhi, along with one of my youngest uncles. So my mum left the country under the guise that we were going on a family vacation, and that's how she justified leaving Kabul. And
to see family.
See family, and that we will be back. My father couldn't. He had to stay behind. So my mum, and we had to be very careful. We didn't pack any family photographs, nothing that would indicate that we were leaving. So we ended up leaving one night with like a few bags, not many photographs, not many things that we cherished, leaving so much behind, a whole life behind, and not knowing when we'll come back. And now I think about it from my mother's perspective, that must have been so hard for her. I was six at that time, so I still have vivid memories of that. And so we went to New Delhi, where we lived with my grandparents and my uncle for a while. I started school there. But it was a really beautiful time for me, because it was the first time as a child where I wasn't fearful of my environment, where, you know, there wasn't the threat of a bomb going off or a missile launching into your front school's front yard.
That's really the base level of the Maslow's hierarchy,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like just feeling safe.
Feeling safe. And as a child, you know, like I talk a lot about this to my friends who were similar age when we left, and the kind of trauma we carry, but it's somehow never been acknowledged in a more kind of wider open ways, where we just kind of have dealt with it and we've carried on, you know, our lives. But it's also hard, you know, just displacement itself is hard, you know, being displaced from a place you're so familiar with. You know, my whole family was in Afghanistan, and overnight we didn't see them,
and not even the photos of
not
of
even
them,
the
yeah.
photos, not even the photos. And even now my mother asks all of our relatives around the world to send us scans of photos we had sent them in the 80s, you know, in post. So that's how we have some childhood photos, but so much of it was lost. And I think it was hard also from the point of view that you're going from one country, one culture, one language, to me being in a primary school in India and not knowing the language at all, you know. And that itself is a different form of, you know, adjustment that it requires, a huge emotional load on a child, I think, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd come in and there was this safety, but at the same time, this really destabilizing thing of having to learn a whole new system, yeah. a whole new place and language.
Yeah, exactly. And getting familiar with the culture. But having said that, we ended up spending 8 years in India, because my father ended up, the only way he could leave was he applied to get a scholarship at one of the universities in India to do his his PhD in Buddhist arts in Afghanistan, which is a big part of Afghanistan. No one talks about, you know, Buddhism and how under Buddhism there was so much cultural activity that happened in Afghanistan and its relics as well. I think, my father, almost a year after we had left, my father joined us in India, and then we moved to Varanasi, which is this holy city in India. It's the center of Hinduism in many ways. And so here we were, an Afghan family, moving from, you know, Afghanistan. I wouldn't say Muslim country, because at that time it was a very, like, under Soviet rule, like, it was a very a communist, no religion. And so moving from that culture to Varanasi was another...
And doing a PhD on Buddhism at the same time.
Exactly. And for us to then get adapted to the school system, learning the language, you know, learning Hindi. And I think by that time, I was pretty confident. One thing a lot of people don't know about Afghans is we grow up on Bollywood. We love Bollywood films. So there is that familiarity that existed. And I think that helped... helped me at least adapt to the new place, the new language. And I think that was really great. The almost 6 years we spent in Varanasi are probably one of the most wonderful years of my life. It was just this incredible place and an incredible time for us as well, because it allowed all of us, my mum, dad, and my grandma had moved from Afghanistan as well by that time, all of us to kind of just ease into this kind of peaceful environment.
Decompress
and just take this huge sigh of relief that we're safe now, it was all okay. And so when my father finished his PhD, he had to go back to New Delhi because we no longer had his student visa to keep us in India. And then that's when we had to apply to come to Australia or Canada, which were the two countries accepting refugees, and we had to register as refugees. And so after 8 wonderful years in India, we came to Australia on Red Cross passports because we didn't have passports.
And why, do you have any sort of sense of why it was Australia rather than Canada, or was it just a bit arbitrary?
No, it was – well, the thing is, those were the two countries who – so this was during the Howard years, and I think they had opened up a huge humanitarian intake, both Canada and Australia. And one of the things that made it easy for us is if you had a relative in any of those countries, they could sponsor you, you know, in the sense that not financially, but actually take responsibility for you when you come and help you. I had an uncle here in Australia, my dad's brother, and an auntie, my mum's sister, in Canada. Applied to both. Australia came quicker. We got interviewed, and we were one of the lucky ones where first interview they gave us the paperwork to do our meds, and then after that, you know, we were here. So it worked out a lot quicker. And for that, you know, like my grandma always said, she always used to say, I'm really grateful to John Howard for this.
It's such a seamless experience and not at all common, yeah, you know, but yeah. Do you remember what it was like first landing in Sydney? I mean, were you 12 years old
I was 14.
14, right.
14. So it was exciting. It was hard because by that age, you know, you're a teenager and you have your whole community of people, you know, you're culturally really embedded. You know, I was really embedded. You know, I was like topping my Hindi in my class. I was doing really well in Sanskrit. Like I felt like I was an Indian girl. Like that was my identity. Even now when people ask me, are you Afghan Australian? I actually find it really hard to say that because I think I've got a lot of Indian in me as well. So coming to Australia at first was very exciting because we didn't have to worry about, you know, going to the Refugee High Commission in Delhi because we had to do that commute so many times to just keep refreshing our visa. And it the promise of a new life as well, which was really exciting, you know. My parents were really relieved that at last, you know, here we can come here and have a life and have an education. That uncertainty was gone. But the interesting thing was that my family, when we first moved in, lived in Yumina because that's where my uncle was. And going from, so after Varanasi, we'd moved to New Delhi. And New Delhi, I don't know if you've been, it's this incredibly busy, thriving city.
A proper city, right?
A proper city, yeah. Thriving. It's a 24-hour city, you know. It's full of light, you know. It's a city that never sleeps, really. So sometimes my parents and I would take walks to the local markets at like 11 p.m. and that was okay. And then going from there to Yumina, which was like at that time it was full of people retiring to Yumina for this kind of quiet life. So there we were, these kind of strange family with accents who had shown up in this kind of quiet village in a way. And there was really nothing happening there. So I think my parents were okay with it. But I think I struggled a lot as a young teenager.
I can only imagine what it was like for you. You know, a lot of people, and like I've got a few friends who are Afghani migrants to Australia, and they will typically land in Auburn or land like deep ensconced in the Afghani community here in Sydney or in Melbourne or Adelaide or wherever they end up. It must have been just such a massive culture shock winding up in Yumina.
It was absolute culture shock. It took a really long time to kind of settle into that. But we had these really lovely neighbours. Our next door neighbour, you know, they were an elderly couple who had retired and moved to Yumina. And so they kind of took us under their wings and just kind of would take us to the movies, which is really great. But even then, it was to be disconnected from that community. I was missing so much of Bollywood, for example. So my cousin, who was living in Parramatta, every weekend would bring her video player with some cassettes that she had got from the local Bollywood shop or local Indian shop. And I would cry watching these because I really missed it. I really missed my school. I missed speaking the language. I think one of the things that people don't understand is how important it is to speak the language that you're comfortable with as a part of your identity, you know. To then not be able to speak Hindi at all was just such a hard thing, you know, going from speaking Hindi and Dari, which is the language Afghan speak, to then kind of not speaking them at all. And then being at the school where everyone was surfing and I couldn't even swim. And, you know, just, I always say this story where I was invited to a pool party and they said, come to my pool party, bring your cozy. And this is pre-Google. And I struggled to understand what a cozy was.
Yeah, wow.
I was so traumatized going, what is a cozy? Just trying to get my head around it. Till my auntie said to me, it means a swimming costume. It's an Aussie slang for it. So I think, you know, things like that, that I just had to recalibrate to that language, to that life, to that cultural shift was huge. But then now it feels like so far away again.
Yeah, how long were you in the Central Coast?
2 years.
Yeah,
right. We were
right.
There for 2 years. And then so I finished my final 2 years of HSC. My family decided that they couldn't get a job there. It was really hard, even if they did, commuting from Sydney. Like, my father is an academic, so there's no way he could find anything there. And then my mum found a job closer to the city, so it was really hard for them to commute. And then we decided to move closer to my cousin, my oldest cousin, who was living in Westmead at that time. So we moved to Westmead, and I went to Arthur Phillip High School, which is one of the oldest high schools, or that's what they say, in Australia. And it was a very mixed multicultural community, and that's where I finished my last 2 years of HSC.
And did your parents, you know, stabilise in work that was kind of relevant for them?
They both had to go to these kind of courses first, set up by Centrelink to help them understand kind of, you know, things within the Australian culture, help them understand the intricacies.
Cozzies.
Cozzies, yeah, that's right, cozzies. But, you know, things like, this is how you write an email, this is how you do things. Emails had just begun, this is how you write an application letter. But I think luckily for my father, he had managed to make some contacts at Sydney University, so he managed to get kind of like a small role just doing some kind of research for their Department of Archaeology. But it wasn't a very stable or permanent job, but I think it was something that he really enjoyed doing, because the reality of a lot of migrants that are highly skilled coming here is they have to pick up another vocation.
Yeah, it's one of the great flaws at the moment for our city. We've got this incredibly skilled group of people who are driving cabs or, you know, working in restaurants and working in, you know, not that those jobs are bad, but we've got, you know, really skilled people who could be contributing a lot more.
Exactly. And I think with my father, with his really, for example, I mean, I use this example, but I'm sure there are many other people, you know, like having this really specialist field of Buddhist arts in Afghanistan and understanding the intricacies of that and what that means for a whole nation and for a whole religion and a whole community. I think then to kind of lose that to something else would have been a real shame. So it's good that he kind of kept involved with that. And then subsequently, after the Taliban were kind of ejected from Afghanistan in 2001, he was then able to go back and re-engage with that through different organizations in the US and in Australia, to be able to go back and engage with it professionally back in the country. So that was really great for him.
Yeah, it must have been really rewarding. You went on to study architecture. In a way, you know, your mum was an architect and a planner. Like, was this kind of like going to the family business in some way?
Not really. I think, like most migrant kids, I was training to be a doctor. I was, everyone would say to me, you know, you're academically really good, so why don't you become a doctor? Because that seems to be the path. And it's, you know, for a lot of immigrant families, you know, that's what you do, right? You're really good at academia and you become a doctor because it's a stable job. It's globally respected. So I was training throughout my HSC for that, and at some point I realized that my marks weren't gonna get me into medicine, and so in my list I just put architecture third. Everything else was medical related, and that was my third preference. Don't ask me why, I just put it there. And having said that, even though my mother was an architect, that was a side of her I rarely, she's an incredibly intelligent mathematician as well, and she was teaching in Afghanistan. But I never saw the architect side of her. I never saw her draw, because she was deprived of that during the war years. So for me, that was never in my head that I would do architecture. But for whatever reason, I just thought, let's just put something else to break the monotony of these kind of medical degrees. And I got in, and I think it was intuition. I just said, let's do a semester of it, see how we feel. And I did a semester of it, and I felt like I'd arrived home. It just felt like the perfect match. And
tell me more about that. Why did it feel like you'd arrived home?
It's just, I think with architecture, I'll often say it's not about the skill of becoming an architect. It's a way of thinking and a way of being. And the first semester was that great introduction, even though I did academically very poorly because I was recalibrating from this medical brain to understanding kind of creative process. But I enjoyed every minute of it. And I attended a lecture by a very beloved professor of architecture, Michael Tawa, who I'm still very much in touch with. He gave a lecture about landscape, parallels between landscape and architecture, and just talked about architecture in a way that wasn't architecture as this building, but it was far more poetic than that. He drew all of these, you know, connecting these dots with poetry, with film, with landscape, with this idea that architecture is just a way of being, and kind of the sensory part of architecture, you know, things that we take for granted, that comes back to the very being of who we are, you know, being able to smell things, being able to touch things. And so he talked about Carlo Scarpa's Brion tomb, which is this incredible building by Italian architect Carlo Scarpa. And that immediately I just thought, this feels right. This feels like I'd love to know more about this. I'd love to engage more with this. And that's how it started. Even though I wasn't doing very well, I just picked up after that point that, you know.
It's funny that architecture is so, in some ways, so applied and almost a completely vocational course through some ways of looking at things. But it's so philosophical and so much about the way we experience space and our cities at large, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what people take for granted. When you say to people, I'm an architect, they just think, okay, you do buildings. But for me, I think the hook, or that thing that made me stay and made me feel at home, was this idea that it was about a way of thinking. It's a way of being and existing in an environment. It didn't have to actually have built components to it. So a park is a work of architecture. You know, the shade of a tree is a work of architecture. So the moment you see that, it almost adds a dimension to the way you're experiencing this kind of environment around you. And then it becomes really important to do it well, you know. So, like, you know when, you know, a tree doesn't give you enough shelter, in the same way that, you know that a footpath is not safe. It goes from micro to macro, you know, this idea of the existence of architecture as a thought, and sometimes as a practice. It's applicable to everything.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I walked in here today. You know, I was last here when this building was first opened, and just walking out on the lawn and feeling the way that the lawn curves up at one corner to create a little bit of a embankment. And now there are a couple of three trees that have matured on top of that hill. And so there's this sort of, it could have just been a flat space, which would have been much more programmable for events and that kind of thing. But it's actually a much more welcoming and interesting space because of that slight incline.
And I think, you know, with architecture, I think one of the things we learn is like this idea of prospect and refuge, you know, that gets talked about. So this idea that we can have some form of refuge in a park, in an open park, is a wonderful idea, right? And I think, you know, one thing that really interests me in architecture is the civicness of it all, you know, and not in civic buildings, but this idea of how much civic generosity exists in any act of architecture. How much do we welcome everyone in and make it for everyone, as opposed to, you know, select few? And I think, you know, that idea that that's applicable to everything. Sometimes it's about a nice handrail, you know, or a nice door handle. You know, I think one of the interesting things was that, you know, when you visit the work of certain modern Scandinavian architects, is this their approach to whole of architecture, which goes from the building to the doors and windows, to the cutlery, to the door handles, to the handrails. And it just makes such a difference, because, you know, there's this, for example, there was this beautiful moment in a church by Sigurd Lorenz, who's a Swedish modernist architect. His work is beautiful, and it's got this egg-shaped door handles to everything, and it just feels so amazing to be able to open a door. So the simple act of opening a door all of a sudden becomes a pleasure.
You know? Special experience.
A special experience. Who would have thought? But it's just like, it's the shape of an egg, and your hand just folds over it ever so delicately, and you just No?
Yeah, I was thinking about, you mentioned Carlo Scarpa before, and I was thinking about the Olivetti showroom in Venice and the way every stair is quite different. Mm. And they're like little sculptural works of art, each kind of interaction you have walking through that building. I mean, it's obviously not a functional and repeatable kind of space. It is like the room is a sculpture, right?
It is. And I think that's where the thinking is, because the architect has conceived of every moment in that space. It's a small space, as you probably remember, that every little act is so carefully considered that it feels, and I don't know, maybe it's worth asking those who are not architects, but I've seen, you know, when I was in Venice visiting it, there was a whole bunch of tourists who are not architects just marveling at all of these details as well. So there was something in that, you know, act of being generous with every detail of architecture, you know, from the small to the big, to the, you know, things like lighting. It makes such a huge difference on your psychology, material, and the sense of touch. You know, I think, you know, for example, this table we're sitting on, you know, just, it's a machine product, and replacing that with something that's a bit more tactile, that's stone or wood, changes your perception of working on that surface. And I think those things make architecture, for me at least.
And obviously as an architect you have a perspective on these things, but I think one of the great things about cities and architecture is that all of us experience them. I'm not an architect, I'm a, you know, a spectator, but you know, we all experience cities and we all have our own insights on them, and, you know, maybe not as kind of expert as someone who's making the things, but we all have a perspective, which makes these conversations really rich and really interesting when you can dive into them. One thing that really interests me is that when you came out of your degree in architecture, it seemed like you were really set on not being an architect, on being a visual artist and being a writer. I mean, I read a quote from you saying that at the time your true passion was writing and visual arts. Does that stand? You know, is that still kind of at the centre of what you're about?
I think so. I think I'm kind of a closeted artist. I really wanted to, when I was studying architecture, I was kind of going over and doing a lot of courses at that time. Was called COFA, College of Fine Arts, now UNSW Art and Design. So I was doing a lot of courses on contemporary installation and sculpture and making things. And, you know, I remember having this horrible burn from a hot glue gun because I was trying to make this super tall, thin sculpture. So I was taking some ideas from architecture into art, and there was a bit of freedom there. And it was, the conversation was a lot more diverse and dare I say, richer in the School of and College of Fine Arts. So I wanted to at some point pivot to becoming, you know, just going into art practice full time. But then, you know, it's that kind of the sunken cost fallacy where you've made so much of your architecture degree, you're like, I might as well finish it. But in many ways, I steered the degree to be akin to an arts practice. So a lot of my projects, sometimes received really well, sometimes not so well, were kind of a deviation from the standard norms of architecture. I never proposed resolved buildings. It was always an idea for something. And with some tutors, it resonated really well. With others, not so much. But I liked it. I liked being in that space and doing what I did. And I just, at some point, also freed myself from that getting that mark, you know, getting a HD. I just thought, you know, this is my freedom. Let's test it. And then when I finished, I wanted to continue that freedom of, like, testing ideas. So, but the reality of architecture practice is that that's not how it is. You know, you either do architecture, you go become an artist. So I think since I finished, I always tried to work for practices that, at least in their thinking and thought, you know, thought a bit outside the box, deviated from that normal conceptual kind of parameters that guide architecture making. But it was more like, where can we borrow ideas from that are not from architecture but from elsewhere? And often it comes from art and writing. And writing is good. I think writing is also my other great love, and I wish I had more time for it. Is, you don't need much tools other than time. You just need time to sit and put thoughts to paper. Whereas, you know, with art, you just, there's a tangible component to it. Whereas with writing, it's all there. And And I was telling you before, you know, I love going to Sydney Writers Festival because hearing writers talk, I just, you know, I get this real energy from them because it's a thing that I like, this idea that you can talk about an idea. You can build a whole city, a whole building through words only, and you don't need much else. So in writing, there's that freedom. But I think my great love of visual arts still remains. And I think that's where my practice is currently, where, you know, we try to overlap with cultural institutions, artists, curators, work with them, facilitate spaces for them, facilitate environments for them. And I think there's an element of satisfaction there.
So sure. when you came out of your degree, were you working in small architecture firms straight off the bat, or were you doing other things? What happened straight out of uni?
Well, I got a job at City of Sydney in their public art department when I was my fourth year of architecture. And I loved that job, even though my friends and my peers were going and working in architecture offices, because that's the requirement of the degree, that you go and work for a practice to gain insight. I somehow managed to get away by working for public art. There I was able to, I was working for Eva Rodriguez Riestra, who has been an incredible friend to me. And so I was working with her, and so she was really great in taking me to meetings. You know, there was public art proposals and presentations that had an element of pragmatics and practicality to it, in the same way that you would commission a work of art. But it was always really fascinating to hear the ideas behind them. And that was just kind of my way of still trying to stay away from normal modes of architecture practice.
Still deeply in thinking about urban spaces, right?
Yeah, about urban spaces, responding to the environment in much kind of poetic and looser ways than just building a thing, right? It was sometimes not a thing as a soundscape, for example, and that's fine too. You know, that was great. And then after I finished, I worked for Sam Marshall on the redevelopment of the MCA as a graduate for 2 years. And so that was fantastic experience as a graduate, because, you know, you get a sense for how these interiors for art.
And another great person to work for, right?
A lovely person, incredible person to learn from as well. You know, I think he also had this incredible, he's a very detail-oriented mind. And I think in those 2 years that I was in his office, I learned quite a lot about focusing on not forgetting the smaller elements of architecture that sometimes make the whole thing. So, you know, learning how to detail a seat to a door handle, you know, those things were really incredible experiences for me as well. And then after that, going and working for the Art Gallery of New South Wales as their in-house designer.
Before we get to that, at the same time you were making artwork, you know, you did some really, a series of interesting projects. You did a project that was, I guess, in partnership or collaboration with the Asylum Seeker Centre, where you planted these pinwheels over Taylor Square. You did another work that was, you know, a film installation at Tin Sheds, and like quite a bit of written work, including fiction, which I haven't been able to track down at all. But the one work that I could find a fair bit of was a 2013 show that you did called The Distance From Here, which was this really dreamy set of photos from, you know, on this big train loop out from Sydney out to Mildura and Broken Hill. Can you tell, like, where did that fit into this process, and how, like, was this still, you know, trying to chart an alternate or a parallel course, or tell me more about that?
I think that was born out of an interest. I'm surprised you found information on that. It was a long time ago. I think that was born out of two things. One was this interest to continue engaging with kind of an arts practice of some sort. But importantly, I think at that time I was also going through, you know, it overlaps with my sense of identity, and for the longest time, you know, trying to understand and fit within a bigger cultural landscape of Australia as an Avon person. I was actually on the trail of Afghan Kamelis, and for the longest time I've been fascinated by them because I have been to these really far out places. I've travelled to, you know, Broken Hill, Burke, Lake Eyre, and everywhere you go you find traces of Afghan Kamelis. And so for me, this project was a way to understand. The thing about Australia for me is that I find it incredibly alien, but at the same time, very familiar. It feels, if someone said home, that's the image I have of these big, vast landscapes, these incredible sunsets. And I thought, what would they have thought of this alien landscape? I mean, they came from a different time, way before me, you know, a whole century before me. And then there were men, you know, who had weird names like me, and I'm sure accents like me. And so for me, it was really interesting to kind of see it through the lens of what did they think of this landscape. And this photographic show was more about kind of taking myself to those spaces and seeing it through that lens and just kind of making an interpretation of that, but through my eyes, of those alien landscapes that were familiar yet so alien. And I think it was really good because it brought me closer to a lot of the stories of the Cameliers and Broken Hill and Burke. And it's also very tragic stories, you know. A lot of them didn't get to go back home. A lot of them were, unlike me, you know, where I feel quite integrated and accepted and loved. A lot of them were rejected by the bigger Australian kind of community of that time. And so it's, a lot of it is really tragic. And so this was just kind of an homage to their life in many ways, and seeing it through the lens of the other, you know, seeing the Australian outback through the lens of not being from here, coming from elsewhere.
What I love about some of this, and for a lot of people, you know, being an artist is something that is like for people who studied art, and being an architect, you do the architecture. And, you know, what I love about what you've done is, you know, you see a way of expressing yourself through all these different channels, and you take that and you step into it, and you're clearly storytelling is a really core part of that. And I guess this kind of goes back to your childhood, growing up with this kind of, you know, a situation where you were discussing poetry and where you were thinking your mum was making clothes, and, you know, there was no part of creativity that wasn't kind of allowed to you. Is that right? Like, do you think that's kind of, because for a lot of people, you know, like Anglo-Australian, but also people who are new migrants to Sydney, you know, the world of art is something that's closed off to them, that they don't feel comfortable going into. They see the institutions and they're like, well, that's not really for me. It seems like that's never been the case for you.
No, and I think part of it is that I just threw myself into that world. You know, for the longest time, a lot of people around me in my community could not understand, you know, why is she out with a camera in the outback? Why is she traveling to outback? For me, that was really important, but I think it's because the architecture degree in many ways opened up that world to be able to express yourself in whatever way you want. It was a much more of a general education degree, if I may say so, because we were allowed to pursue art and poetry and other things to inform our architecture. That kind of freedom existed in the first 3 years of our degree. And I knew how much important these stories, these narratives were in terms of understanding my new home as well. You know, reading a lot of Australian literature very early on helped me understand things, and also Australian films. I remember watching Muriel's Wedding and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and I found them so strange but so fascinating. And
yeah, Muriel's Wedding feels very Central Coast.
Very Central Coast. And I remember watching it before we arrived in Australia, and I thought, what is this? I just could not get my head around it, but I watched it till the end. And then coming and experiencing it, it just felt like so raw and real, you know. This was the reality, the hills hoist, the really bright kind of environment. Like those were the things that I guess familiarized me with Australia before I came. So I had that access, I guess, and that intrigue about my new home that I was trying to understand through art, through writing, through film. But I think for me it was also interesting in 2014, I think it was, maybe I'm getting the year wrong, they brought a collection of Afghan treasures to be exhibited at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And the gallery did this wonderful thing. I wasn't working there at that time. Did this wonderful thing where they reached out to the Avon community in Western Sydney and arranged buses for them to come for the opening. Had an opening exclusively for Avon's Avon food catering, Avon music. And it was the first time I saw my community come into these spaces that I had only visited, and I'd never seen anyone from there. And it was actually quite lovely, and it made me realize that the reason why they don't have that access is because we're not facilitating that, you know, through education, or through, you know, I mean, high schools organize these excursions, but what about older Avons who would really love to see that? And people took so much joy in seeing these artifacts, these ancient artifacts that had arrived, you know, that was from their land, and it was beautiful, and it wasn't tinged by war or anything else. So after that, I kind of had this realization that it was just the accessibility of these things, that a lot of this is not being facilitated by whether institutions or school programs. And so recently, when a group of Avons arrived on emergency flights after the Taliban takeover, through an organization I took, as an interpreter, we took them to the Art Gallery of New South Wales and showed them all the Indigenous artworks in the collection, just to say, this is what your new country is. And they were fascinated. They had so many questions like, you know, how many Aboriginal people live in Australia? What do they speak? You know, so there was this, art was a way in which they got an access to the country that they had just arrived in. And it was just a really lovely way, because there was no other way to familiarize them with that.
And clearly that was part of the way that you've become familiarized as well. You know, so much of your work has been about working in museums and cultural spaces. How much of that experience did you bring into it, of having seen, you know, your community and, you know, other communities kind of engaging with cultural institutions?
I think one of the things that really, part of the reason why we do that, the cultural work and how, you know, the enjoyment in it for us, is that it's for everybody. And so when we engage with it, we make sure that it's designed in a way that's accessible. I spoke about radical accessibility at a forum a couple of years ago, and this idea that it's the language, it's how you decide to show something. And I know it's not coming from a curatorial perspective, because I'm not in charge of telling narratives, but it's coming from, you know, a design perspective. How can you make a space enjoyable, accessible, equitable for everyone? And how do you tell those stories and those narratives in a way that everyone can enjoy? So you just don't make them, you know, super closed off, or you open it up for everyone.
The urban design is so crucial for that, to like whether you feel welcomed into a space and how you access it. You went off and did a Biara Hadley traveling scholarship. It's now been, you know, quite a few, it's almost a decade since you went on that trip. How much did that shape your thinking? You know, you've had enough time, I guess, 10 years to reflect on which bits you took away that were useful.
Look, I think I'm very grateful for that trip, because I kind of applied for that after quitting one of the job I was working at that time. And I think for me, in many ways, I knew that I wanted to work in the space, in cultural space and in civic spaces. So, you know, a lot of our work as an architect, I never enjoyed working on single residential homes and things like that. So for me, it was understanding how is that approached, you know, this idea of civicness and a cultural space, best practice, art galleries and museums elsewhere in the world, you know, what contributes to that? Is it just architecture? You know, if we talk about great museums, is it architecture? Is it a mix of curation, architecture, but also a greater civic agenda by the institution? And I think coming back, I realized that, you know, it's this notion, I think as architects, we're all trained to think we're like these mighty heroes that, you know, have these pens and we just draw over our city. But, you know, a lot of these institutions are actually shaped by more than the architects. You know, they're shaped by the client who commissions it, and if the client has got an agenda that's, you know, that's contributing towards a civic generosity, or, you know, curators who decide to inhabit those spaces in ways that the architect never imagined or never thought of. Louisiana, for example, is a prime example of that. The architects for that are long gone. They designed it in the 70s and they have been adding to that since. But it's just how the organization's taken reins of this place and how they use these spaces. They're not grand spaces, except for the, you know, one of the rooms. Everything else is quite intimate and small.
Quite modest, right?
Quite modest, but it's just, it feels like a walk in the park. I went there on, you know, when I, for my scholarship, it was a nice summer afternoon, And, you know, you go into a gallery, you look at a collection of works, and you come out, you're in the park, and it's beautiful, clear skies. Then you go back in, and you can spend a whole day just meandering through this space. And part of it is that, you know, reading about it was just, that's how it was commissioned, that it was meant to feel like a park. It was meant to feel like this kind of really relaxed experience of art. And it actually feels that way. It's achieved that. And
it sits in its neighborhood really in a really subtle kind of way. It doesn't, yeah. It's not like a, you know, one of those big Starchitect kind of fancy buildings that's, you know, everyone wants to take photos from the outside of. It's quite modest to enter.
It's quite modest to enter, but it feels like it's also doing justice to the kind of art. In part, you know, it's the artists and the curators that, you know, often get forgotten in these conversations about art galleries and museums. You know, who are these spaces for? And I think that is a good example of that, that, like you said, you know, the Starchitect Museum and galleries that people want to take photo with the facade, but the interior sometimes fails as the right venue for a particular art or...
Yeah, I was moderating a interesting conversation a week or two ago with Kate Levin, who used to be the Commissioner of Culture in New York after 9/11, and so she had this really interesting program there. But everything that she kept on drawing the conversation back to was about the small end, and we talked quite a bit about public art, and she said this really interesting thing that, you know, everyone talks about public art as the object that comes out at the end, but she described it as actually the process that develops the art of working with the community and working on what is required and having the artist and the civic authority and everyone collaborate on that. She said it built civic muscle tone that can be used in a whole bunch of other ways, you know, democratic ways or community ways. You know, it sort of builds a richer community. And another conversation that I was fortunate enough to have was with Melissa Malu, who created the new Pacifica collection at the Australian Museum, and her talking about the process of creating that with the Pacifica community in Sydney was so rich, because it was this deep engagement with the community that led into... It's quite a simple room at the museum, but the work and the sense of connection into her community that underpins that room made it feel just tremendously rich, like so much more than I could have expected.
Yeah, I think that kind of sense of ownership, you know, community ownership is something, again, not discussed enough, especially when we're commissioning civic works of architecture. You know, to what extent do we engage people, give them a sense of ownership over these spaces? You know, for example, one of the comments I got from someone in my community when they came for the art gallery exhibition of the Afghan treasures was they said, I never thought we could come inside the building, you know, because it feels so imposing. And they've got these tiny doors with a security guard at the front. So, you know, small things like that, or when you walk in, is there a space to sit? And, you know, sometimes it's the small gestures, but this idea of empowering the community to have a say in the kind of spaces that they and the future generation will occupy, you know. So it might not be me, but it might be my children that will use those spaces. And I think it's so important to hear people out rather than impose an agenda of architecture.
Over the past decade or so, you've worked on a range of just, you know, like quite exceptional work, you know, from quite small scale. You know, I mentioned right at the start the beautiful work with Urban Theatre Projects that they're showing at Bankstown Art Centre at the moment. You know, like quite a modest, simple set for that work, right through to work for the NGV, the Powerhouse Renewal. I know you're like in a crunch time for like another stage on that project at the moment. Homes, like residential homes, a range of different projects. When you think back about the kind of work that you've done over that time, what are the projects or the moments that you think back that you're like, oh, that's where I'm hitting the mark? That's where I'm really kind of nailing the kind of work that I want to do?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, look, for me, I think the shift really happened when we started our own practice, because up until that point I'd been working for others. So one of the big shifts that happened in starting my own practice was being able to pursue things without much of much limitation imposed on that kind of creative practice. And I think that has allowed me to test with each project an idea that I'd always been interested in but somehow wasn't able to pursue because of the framework of my job at that time. And so, for example, sustainability is one thing, and we did this show for Carriage Works in 2020, it opened in 2021. And it was part of an invited EOI that we won, and it was to come up with a set of enclosures or rooms for 12 artist-run initiatives, but do it in a way, I mean, that was the brief. And so our thing was like, well, we don't want to build booths with, you know, like white walls. Let's do something different and radical. And so we came up with this system that, you know, at that time, I remember we'd just emerging from the lockdown and we went to Bunnings and sourced everything from Bunnings. So just seeing these ideas that you don't have to be precious, not everything has to be, you know, marble and precious materials, but, you know, you can be quite economical. And we ended up building this system that could be dismantled and reused after the show, and it did that quite successfully. You know, I think the principles of that project are something I want to replicate ongoing, you know, this idea that it was also done very quickly. So we didn't have the indulgence of thinking and drawing, and like it was just executed in a matter of weeks from when we were commissioned to when it was built. It was, I think, 6 or 8 weeks. So super fast, and I think it was rewarding because of that.
Which is such a creative and artistic process, right? And so different to your normal architectural process. Belle, this has been so great to talk to you. I've really loved it. Before I let you go, I just want to ask you three quick questions.
Sure.
First up, what's keeping you up at night right now?
I think one of the things that I worry about, I think, the most, so I have a young child, I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I can't help but draw parallels between her life and the lives of many women and children. And it worries me because, you know, like, I think, you know, like, for example, in Afghanistan, it's been almost 900 days since the Taliban banned girls from going to secondary schools and universities. And it bothers me, not just for them, but this idea that I'm also an Afghan woman and I have benefited so much from freedom of the life that I have, but the education I've received, and the thought of that, and people as young as my daughter being deprived of a future, you know, that no matter how successful my life is in Sydney, no matter how much I achieve, that will always bother me. That always is at the back of my mind. So I think that I can't escape that thought. It just, even during my really great moments, it's almost like a haunting, you know,
There's nothing like seeing that kind of thing through your children as well to bring it home. Second question, who else should I be speaking to?
There's so many people. Look, I recently heard April Phillips talk. She's the artist for the UTP. You could talk to her. She has great insights, an incredible artist. Afghan friends who might be able to offer up more perspective on Australian life, but outside of that, I would highly encourage you to talk to Khadim Ali. He's an Afghan contemporary artist. He's got so much insight into an incredible creative. You can hear him talk for hours and hours. I have to think about that. I think there's so many people that fascinate me, but I don't know who you've spoken to. So.
Part of this is selfish, you know, like I just want to find out about great things that are happening in our city.
Yeah.
And this is a great way to like mine the minds of some great people. But I would love to find out more about those guys.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm recommending artists, but there's some great, I think you should speak to Second Edition. They're an enterprise. Two young architects running, a company that recycles or reuses construction waste. And I think I'm just so in awe of their entrepreneurial energy and clarity. So they're great. But I'll have a think. I just can't.
This is
I'll
good.
Send you a list.
Yeah, please do. Last question. What gives you hope?
It's a difficult question because right now I feel hopeless about many things about the world, but I don't know. I think just having experience and watching human resilience play out daily, seeing the resilience of human spirit, kind of getting past some really dark moments. I think that's what makes me feel like that's what our humanity is. And I think, you know, seeing great acts of empathy as well, I think it's a very rare thing that I find, especially like I think in this context, everyone's so busy, you know, busyness is the word. How are you, Matt?
So busy,
you know, like this is the conversation. And I think for me, when I see people get time out of that busyness to do something outside of themselves is what makes me feel hopeful about the humanity and the human spirit, you know, this the fact that we're still capable of being kind and selfless.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's what this podcast is about entirely, is getting some time away from all those kind of things. Yeah. But I love seeing that empathy as well.
Yeah.
Belle, it's been so great to speak to you. If people are listening to this and have never seen your work one way or another, what are you pointing them to at the moment?
I think we have quite a few projects on at this point. Some of them we can't speak in great detail, but we have our first international project opening in M+ in Hong Kong end of this year. So we're very excited about that. And we continue work on the Powerhouse. So that will be with a great team. We have an exceptional team of architects, urban designers, landscape architects that, so whenever that happens, they can keep up themselves updated on that. Other than that, I think, we just have smaller projects, houses and much smaller things that, you know, we will share in due time. But yeah, I think those are the two main things.
This was produced and hosted by me, Matt Levinson. If you haven't heard the previous interviews in this series, I really recommend you go back and listen to some of them. Ben Peake was a really great interview. Jess Hill, the amazing journalist and change maker. Sean Christie David, who I'm indebted to him for opening Kabul Social, for amazing Afghani food in the city. There's some really great stories of people making great change in our city. So I really recommend you dig back into those. If you know someone who'd be into listening to this podcast, please let them know about it. That's really the best way that people find out about a podcast like this. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for being part of this, Belle.
Thank you for having me.
I might have a story for you.